Please the court, William Fritchie, registration number 36498. I appear on behalf of Mr. West. This case does involve a sexual assault on a child. However, I don't believe that the issues that are pertinent to this appeal will involve reference to her name at all. Your Honors, this is a case coming post People versus Shari. And a little bit of history, I think, is important here. I was appointed to handle Mr. West 35C by ADC in 2007. We put it together. I indicated to him that the best issue was this conflict of interest and that we had solid case law on our side, and that I thought that he would prevail on this issue. We were set for a hearing before Judge Deister in Grand Junction in January of 2009. The prosecution replaced the assistant that would be handling this case 1 week before the hearing, and lo and behold, the sheriff had a problem getting Mr. West to the courthouse, so the matter got continued for a long period of time. During that interim, the Shari case was announced, which dramatically impacted how we would proceed with this 35C. The Shari case dealt with potential conflicts of interest that were imputed. And it was a dramatic departure from current case law. As late as 2008, when Close versus People was decided, that also imputed cases within the public defender's office and across regional offices. It would be our first position that Mr. West is entitled to the law that it was in effect at the time of his trial, not as it was changed in 2009, some six or seven years after his conviction.
Counsel, may I just interrupt briefly to
Absolutely.
Ask? Obviously, the case turns in part on interpretation of the rules of professional conduct, and those were changed January of 2008. Which set of rules applies? Those that were in effect at the time of trial or those that are currently in effect?
I believe, Your Honor, and I don't know that the rules, there's a significant change in the areas prior to Shari, but I think that we should be looking at the rules that existed at the time.
Is that a point made in the trial court?
You know, preparing for this hearing, I reflected on that question, and I came to the conclusion that I probably could have handled this 35C better in front of Judge Deister on that very point, that I didn't put enough emphasis on arguing that what we should be talking about was what was in effect in the time period that is relevant to this case, which would be 2002-2003. So I would admit to Your Honors that, I think I could have done a better job at the district court level. Going into the hearing, I had to change, at least that's the way I felt I needed to do, and at least deal with Shari, and brought in an expert, Colleen Scissors, and we talked a lot about how this case differs, the West case differs from the facts in Shari, and I think there are some serious distinctions that the court, that I'd like to draw to the court's attention. In Shari, the public defenders notified all former clients and got waivers from them. They notified Shari himself of a potential conflict and had a waiver from him. They notified all regional offices, placing them on notice not to share information. That wasn't done in this case. And they carefully followed public defender's statewide conflicts of interest policy in the Shari case. And I believe that, and I struggled with that decision. I found it a little bit difficult to grasp, and maybe that's just my shortcomings. But it just seemed to me that the facts were so different because they followed the public defender conflicts of interest rules, which was not done in Mr. West's case. The Sharp case states that conflicts of interest will not be automatically imputed to other public defenders that dealt with an imputed conflict. Our position is that Mr. McNulty had a direct and actual conflict himself without having to have a conflict imputed.
Do you read Shari as being dependent upon the rule change?
They seem to address it in that fashion, yes. That's my reading of the case by the Supreme Court, is that they based it factually upon the fact that the public defender scrupulously followed the conflict of interest rules in Mr. Shari's case, and that there had been a change in the professional rules. But that's not something that I argued very well in the district court, and I will admit that. The actual and direct conflicts of Mr. McNulty was one that he failed to advise Mr. West of a potential conflict. And the fact that Dan Staggs, the critical prosecution witness, had been a frequent flyer in that office, I mean, we're talking over 20 cases where she had been represented by the public defenders, should have put him on notice that there may be a conflict issue here. Not only that, but that office, the Mesa office, had a duty to protect the confidentiality of Deanne Staggs and Donald Staggs, who was the other parent who testified, because they represented him as well, and they had a duty to protect their confidentialities, and that puts them in kind of an irreconcilable problem when it comes to ethics, because here they're trying to defend, their office over there is defending the confidentiality of these two very key prosecution witnesses, while on the other hand defending Mr. West. We submit that they failed in Mr. West's case to implement the ESD. It's quite clear that there was contact between Mesa and Colorado Springs. The El Paso office was actively representing Deanne Staggs during Mr. West's trial, and Mr. McNulty, who was representing Mr. West, was using the El Paso office to help him investigate the case.
Specifically, counsel, what did Mr. McNulty receive from El Paso County? Or through his investigator, or whether it was direct or not, what is in the court file? What did it contain?
I think the record's a little unclear on that, Your Honor, because Mr. McNulty couldn't quite remember, but it's very clear that he asked them to investigate to find out locations of witnesses. He gave them subpoenas to serve, which divulges the fact that he's representing Mr. West, which was a violation of the rules. I think both the rules of professional conduct and the public defender rules, to divulge the fact that he was representing Mr. West. But they also had him go look, their investigator to go look for witnesses, and they asked him to serve subpoenas, and they asked him for some court records from El Paso County.
He asked the DS. They were asking to investigate El Paso to investigate DS.
DS being the prosecutor.
Right, right, I know.
Yes. Okay.
I forgot. Never mind.
Okay. I would submit that Mr. McNulty needed to protect himself from sanctions from ORC and the public defenders. He testified that he knew his supervisor, David Eisner, would not be happy with what he was doing. Both he and Tracy Renner does the appeal, and then without ever so much as entering an entry of appearance, later files a 35B out of Denver on behalf of Mr. West. And I would submit that that's showing a statewide representation of Mr. West at the time. And that's the way public defenders acted back then. That's the way they operated, that it was run statewide office, and after all, that was the status of the law right up through 2008. When you show a conflict of interest, you do not show prejudice. There is one issue, if I may get my glass of water.
Sure, yes.
Thank you. The issue that there's no need to show prejudice, but there's two lines of cases on the issue of adverse effect. And I would submit that current Colorado Supreme Court case law is People versus Castro, and they don't talk about showing an adverse effect. They talk about if there will be or is likely to involve the attorney likely to involve representing different interests. And it talks about what the attorney refrains from doing more than what he does. And it seems...
Did the trial court make a finding that his representation of the husband, Diaz, did not create a conflict? He entered his appearance, but then there's no record that he did something on behalf of it.
Judge Sessions pretty much found that that relationship had not gone far enough for him to find a conflict. And I believe he was pretty clear on that holding thing.
If we did look to a test of adverse effect, what in this record would reflect an adverse effect?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's where I was going next. And I'd like to get done here in a couple more minutes. I just would like to throw one thing before I go there. The most recent Court of Appeals case, there were some cases, Mira, Kenny, Mata, that talked about the necessity of showing an adverse effect. People versus Curran, which was a 2009 Court of Appeals decision, went back to the Castro finding of no need to show adverse effect. We would submit that even if the court determines that we need to show adverse effect, that there was plenty. One, he failed to file a brief in an attempt to get Dan Stagg's PSI report. Two, he testified that he dropped the ball in that regard. So he knows that Judge Massaro, I believe, was the trial judge. Maybe confusing. Anyway, he was given a period of time to file a brief in support of his position that he wanted to get parts of the pre-sentence investigation. He didn't do it. And he admits he didn't do it, and he admits he dropped the ball. In the public defender's statewide policy, they talk about the benefit of collective brainstorming within a regional office. That each lawyer is supposed to take advantage of the collective knowledge of other lawyers. Almost impossible in this situation because so many of Mr. McNulty's comrades had represented D.N. or Donald Stagg, almost better than half the office. They didn't cross-exam D.N. or Donald Stagg on the domestic violence conviction for which Mr. Stagg was doing time during the pendency. Mr. Stagg was in jail doing a sentence for driving under revocation and domestic violence, and that's why the child was with the mother when this happened. Then he didn't cross-examine Dean Stagg about the fact that she's living with Lee Fizz, who is a prosecution witness, or at least available. He was in the room at the time this allegedly took place. There was an active protection order keeping those two apart. Would have been great cross-examination. Wasn't done. I would like to leave my last bit of time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you. Have about a minute 54, 53, I guess.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Carol Spedigue, attorney registration 39208, and I represent the people in this matter. So this defendant, in this case, is essentially alleging that his public defender, Mr. McNulty, labored under an actual or imputed conflict of interest because of these two prosecution witnesses, and that People v. Sherry does not apply because Mr. McNulty violated the public defender's policy on information sharing when he was working through El Paso County to get some information on Mrs. Stagg's. So for ease of reference, I'm going to work on this backwards so that we can start with why People v. Sherry does apply and then apply the case to both of the prosecution witnesses.
Also, can I just interrupt you briefly?
Sure.
I'm concerned about the same question I asked your opposing counsel, and that is which rules apply here? Because I think the change in rule 1.10 is pretty significant on the imputation issue.
So well, I think the first time that this was never raised in the opening brief or the reply brief, and so I would like to, you know, so the people didn't have the opportunity to fully brief that question in particular because it wasn't raised by the defendant, and so to the extent that I'm kind of flying by the seat of my pants right now, I would like to say that I believe that People v. Sherry essentially said that the rule in 1.11 and applying it to the public defender's office pretty much always existed, and that it should have always kind of been interpreted that way, because rule 1.11 essentially said the government agency, you know, individual attorneys in a government agency should not have imputed conflicts, you know, that extends to the entire agency.
Excuse me, counsel, does that contradict though earlier cases on this issue about imputing?
It would. It would contradict the earlier cases.
So would that suggest that rule 11 changed the law?
No, I think it would suggest that people, that the it wasn't automatically, I think Sherry essentially said that the public defender's office would qualify as the government entity pursuant to 1.11. And so I think it just clarified that issue, because I think it would have been easy, the previous cases seem to find that, you know, with all of these offices working in conjunction together, we better err on the side of caution. And I think Sherry essentially said, no, you know, the PD's office is a governmental agency and we should, you know, treat it as such. And
wasn't that new?
Pardon?
Wasn't the holding in Sherry and the application of the change 1.11 new and a departure from the cases like Rodriguez?
Well, again, I'm not completely familiar with the timing issue because I didn't get a chance to actually brief it, and so it would seem that that was the case, that it was new, or at least a new interpretation of the law, as you know, according that maybe was then existing, but I guess the case law would have interpreted it otherwise, but it seemed like Sherry was saying that this should have been the case all along, because 1.11, the comment of 1.11 had said this all along. And so I guess it would be our position that the prior cases had interpreted it incorrectly.
And you believe that we ought to apply the new rule to this fact situation, even though Sherry hadn't been decided and the rule hadn't been changed?
I do believe so, yes.
Okay.
Now, let's talk a little bit about People v. Sherry. The Colorado Supreme Court, in that case, the defendant seems to want to point out a lot of the factual, that there were a lot of factual differences, but I would submit that there were actually a lot of factual similarities, and in fact, that directly applied, because we had three witnesses that were being, two public defenders appointed to represent a defendant, and there were three prosecution witnesses that had, one had been represented by the same office on five different occasions, but not by the same attorneys. Another witness had been represented by other branches of the public defender's office on three prior cases. And the third witness had seven prior cases, and with an eighth one actually pending at the time that the defendant was going through his trial.
But in that case, I'm sorry to interrupt your counsel, sure. But in that case, didn't they call in those witnesses and make it clear that there could be a potential conflict, and those individuals waived that?
Yes, in that case they did, but...
But in this case, there was no suggestion that DS or her husband were ever advised about a potential conflict.
Well, I don't think that... Well, first of all, I don't believe that we necessarily need to be too... The issue here is pertaining to the defendant and his conflict of interest and whether or not his attorney labored under a conflict of loyalties. And so... To the extent that the defendant is raising all of these arguments pertaining to the privilege that we should be afforded to the two prosecution witnesses, while I understand those are concerns in general, I don't know that they necessarily apply to the defendant's case. He doesn't have standing to raise privilege issues and conflict issues on the behalf of other people who are represented by the public defender's office. So while I understand that, you know, this is... Because you can't have both flips of the coin. On the one hand, you would argue he's not doing enough because they have these other prosecution witnesses that he may or may not have loyalties to. But then on the flip side, say, well, he's also doing too much because these prosecution witnesses, you know, you have to protect their interests as well, and they're your clients. And so to kind of focus down the arc, to focus the issue, I guess you need to get back to the Sherry holding, which says that for a direct conflict to exist, the same individual attorney must be involved in both cases simultaneously, or the conflicted attorney must have received confidential material information from the former client. We don't have that here. We just simply don't. You know, Mr. McNulty did not simultaneously represent Mrs. Staggs. She was a frequent flyer, for, you know, lack of a better term, in the office, but it was never him personally representing her. And so while I understand that it would seem to raise concerns, it really doesn't, because we have here there's no imputed conflict when it's a different, when it's different attorneys acting on behalf of a on behalf of the witness, and then applying that to the defendant's case. Also, the case that was currently being prosecuted in El Paso County, though, again, completely different attorneys, and there was no evidence in the record that somehow she had shared information, or the information had been shared about the defendant or pertaining to the defendant's case. So again, that does not conflict with the Sherry hearing or the Sherry holding. I would say also, as to the allegation that the defendant, or that the Mr. McNulty somehow violated the public defender policy on the screening policy. Again, Mr. Frischi was involved in the case intimately, so he seems to have a really good handle on the record, but I would say I don't recall anything in the record. He reiterated many times in the post-conviction hearing that nothing confidential or material was being sought. He was essentially getting the court file. He was looking for impeachment information about the defense, or about the prosecution witness. So he was asking for, you know, her criminal history, essentially, which is a public record. He could have gotten this through the court file, and he admitted I probably should have just gone through the court records. But this is the public defender's office sending a courtesy copy to Mr. McNulty because they already have it. Here you go. Here's the copy of the court file, something you could find, you know, as a public record. There's no violation of the screening policy by doing so. The screening policy pertains to the confidential public defender file, which is, you know, attorney notes, privileged information, that kind of a stuff. And that's not what he was looking for. So,
and is the record clear that all he received was public information?
The hearing, that's what he represented, was that he basically was looking for the court file. And so his investigator, you know, while it's, you know, obviously it's cleaner if you go through the court, because you don't have these issues of, oh, were you information sharing, was there? But his investigator, I guess, you know, they try and save a little time, but just, you know, calling up the next public defender office saying, hey, can you fax us over the court file? And so it seems like that's what happened here.
What about the suggestion counsel made that there was an actual investigation through El Paso County of the witnesses?
And that was my reference. I'm not familiar with that from the, it's a very lengthy hearing transcript, so I might have missed it, but from what I recall, I don't remember anything having to do with an investigation on behalf of the defendant, you know, the El Paso County office doing any sort of investigation on behalf of the defendant. So moving on to the second prosecution witness, Mr. Staggs. Now, in that case, Mr. McNulty did personally represent him. However, his representation of Mr. Staggs had been before the defendant's case even came to be. And the circumstances were such, as the court noted, you know, this was basically an entry of appearance on a domestic violence case that was then dismissed 4 days later. Mr. McNulty doesn't even remember representing him, meeting him. You know, there was essentially zero contact between the two individuals.
He did remember that it was a domestic violence case.
He remembered that he thinks that he had entered an appearance. It was like an automatic entry kind of a thing. And so he felt, I think that the transcript was, I remember, you know, his name or something like that, but that was the extent of it. He doesn't think he even ever met him personally because 4 days later it was dismissed.
He did not testify at the hearing that it was a domestic violence case?
I don't recall specifically.
I don't recall either.
Yeah, I don't recall specifically if he was able to get that specific with it. So, but I think those factors, the fact that he... that the defendant's case was already, or I'm sorry, that they never coincided, and that there was no evidence that the attorney, that Mr. McNulty obtained any confidential information from Mr. Staggs regarding the defendant or this case, are very significant, because as this court found in People v. Samuels, that's pretty much what would have been necessary in order to find a conflict. Also in Sherry, you know, again, the reiteration that the representation of the defendant didn't coincide and there was no information sharing. So I think those are all pretty important. And so I guess for...
And in Sherry, too, just to refresh my memory,
sure.
In Sherry, the defendant was asked on these issues and made a record on whether or not he felt there was a conflict.
I believe you're right.
And here, of course, Mr. West, there was never any discussion at the trial level at the time of the trial concerning a possible or potential conflict.
Correct. I think, well, Mr. West represented at the post-conviction hearing, but at no time prior to this that he had asked counsel about, you know, whether or not it was strange that, you know, the public defender office. But this was only at the post-conviction hearing after these allegations were raised. And Mr. McNulty at the post-conviction hearing said he doesn't ever remember, you know, Mr. West raising it.
I'm sorry to interrupt again, counsel.
Sure. No, you're fine.
The burden would be on Mr. West, though.
Yes.
When this issue arises.
Correct. It would have been Mr. McNulty. However, if there wasn't a potential conflict, or he didn't feel that there was any conflict because he never represented any of these prosecution witnesses, then I don't know that there should have been an onus on him to raise kind of something in the abstract that, you know, obviously at the point when it did get litigated, turned out to be nothing. So I don't know that we can necessarily ding him for not potentially raising a conflict issue when there is no conflict issue.
Question of adverse effect, the your opposing counsel mentioned that Mr. McNulty did not cross-examine either of the Staggses, I guess, on the domestic violence charge against Mr. Staggs. Doesn't that present a bit of a problem?
Well, Mr. McNulty actually testified at the post-conviction hearing that he kind of had to pull back a little bit on his cross-examination of Mrs. Staggs because he felt like it was a strategic decision because he felt that the jury was sort of perceiving him as beating up the prosecution witness. And so I think that's a valid, you know, strategic decision to make, that, you know, you're the mother of the victim is essentially being beat up on the stand. And so he presented, you know, many of her previous cases as impeachment evidence, and then kind of, I guess, decided to pull back after he got the sense that the jury was sort of being turned off by, you know, the idea that he was being a little too tough on her. So I would say that the record supports the fact that he was not only zealous, but maybe even overly zealous in terms of going after both Mr. and Mrs. Staggs, maybe not as to that particular case dealing with the domestic violence, but certainly as to the many others that they had. So he also, if you look at his testimony, his cross-examination of Mrs. Staggs was very lengthy. So, you know, it's not as though he was cutting corners or letting her off easily. And he also testified that he just didn't have any, you know, loyalties to either of these individuals. He never represented any of them personally, and there was no reason for him to, you know, he doesn't even remember meeting Mr. Staggs. So to promote the idea that somehow he had these, you know, I guess, underlying loyalties that were somehow going to raise up at the point that he was representing the defendant, I think would be a stretch of the record, and it would support the trial court's findings. As to the defendant's position that he may not have to even show adverse effects, I would argue that I agree that Castro is sort of an interesting case because it doesn't necessarily say that you have to have the adverse effect, but it kind of merges the concepts, and that's what was found in People v. Curran, which was that Court of Appeals, 2009 Court of Appeals case. And so by merging, I would submit that means you still have to show it. It's just a part of the conflict of interest finding. So you do have to show an adverse effect. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Fritchie?
Thank you. I'll try to get these in the time left. I would submit, number one, we're arguing that it's his own failures, it's an actual and direct conflict. We don't even need to get to the imputed, but we think we're entitled to that imputation, if that's the correct term. Mr. McNulty was in a position defending himself, his interests as opposed to Mr. West. I did brief...
At the trial, you're saying he was in the position of defending himself?
Yes, because he didn't raise these potential conflicts that he should have been aware of. And one of my points is that the conflicts policy was not implemented at all in this case.
Does the record indicate that he was aware of the other representation of the prosecution witnesses through the public defender's office?
Well, That's a good question. I would think he would have had it known, and I guess I was always assuming that he knew. But, you know, he quickly got off the Donald Stakes case, which, by the way, was filed as a felony domestic violence, and I think everyone knew that. He recused himself on that case, and I think because he recognized the name. But his office had certainly represented the Stakes on 20-plus occasions in Mesa County. I did brief and argue Rodriguez and submit that that case does hold in this one. And there are three DSs. There's the mother, the father, and the mother's brother, who is another DS. And that was the party that they asked Colorado Springs or El Paso County to go find in their investigation.
Did that come out at the hearing?
I'm sorry?
Did that come out at the hearing?
I believe it did. I couldn't cite you to page or volume or page, but I believe that it did. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted and will be decided in due course. We're going to